Hello and welcome to Starter Set. My name Ed Sylvester. This is
also Sam Bradley.
And welcome to the show that rewrites myths and legends. Sam.
Yep.
Number one, how are you feeling?
Better. Excellent. Thank you very much. My voice is still a little bit... but yeah, feeling better. How are you feeling? You were sniffing all over the place.
I've de-snotted.
Lovely term.
It was a lovely term. Don't go into the spare room of my house. I still got a little bit of something rolling in the back around me.
A little bit of
yeah, exactly. But all well and good. Listen, it's the run-up to the festive time of the year, so that's always...
Yes, it is.
Bloody lovely!
Out of nowhere, isn't it?
Fucking yes. Hell. Yeah, you got a very interesting Secret Santa the other day, didn't you?
Oh, shout out to the Secret Santa. By day, I have a real job, and I got given some edible dice, like gummy dice. And they look, do you know what? The weird thing is I unwrapped them and I thought, oh, this is cool. Someone like has heard that I play D&D because I never shut the fuck up about it. And they're like, got me some dice. I was like, oh, they look a bit hard to read, but I don't want to be rude. I was like, oh, that's great. You know, it's the thought that counts. And then I kept reading the packaging. I was like, oh no, there's something else afoot here. And I popped the D4 into my mouth. I was like, oh, this is amazing. I mean, it almost went horribly wrong if they hadn't been edible.
Sure.
But they're great. And I just want to kind of be in the game and just be like, rolling so poorly and just put it into my mouth.
I love the idea of doing that without letting anybody know that they're
obviously,
edible dice
that's
as well.
The full, yeah, that's exactly. The full package, isn't it? Yeah. That was great. That was a proper snazzy little gift.
And the creators of said dice, I think, definitely work on the same creative term that we do, which is pun first and then... stuff yes. backwards, which because they're called what they called Sam.
Oh, good question.
How can I remember that? I haven't even got them. They're called goblin dice because you're gobbling them up, aren't you?
Because you're gobbling them up. Yeah, I became confused because I've found that there's another D&D shop nearby where I live called Two Fat Goblins.
Oh, nice, like that.
So that
too.
Was where the that was where the crossover came. But yeah, the goblin dice.
That reminds me of a poem that my father used to say to me.
Is it appropriate to be read on air?
Yeah, it's fine. But I'll use your two fat goblins instead, which is two fat goblins sitting in the bath. One blew off and the other one laughed. There you go.
That's nice.
That's a little bit of the Sylvester upbringing for you.
Say, there. It's Papa Sylvester bringing the bars.
Yeah, very much so. So look, this week we're kind of going a little bit backwards in time.
Time.
Nice.
Time in backwards.
Thank you.
That's backwards. It's kind of backwards.
Yeah, kind of. It's Yoda speak. Because we... It's well, basically, this is week ascending 1.001 because it's just a singular episode one. But look, we managed to get in contact with John Hodgson of Handiwork Games, who are the...
He sounds like a talented individual with an excellent product. Tell me more, Ed. Tell me more.
Excellent. What a talented individual with an excellent product. For John is part of the team that created Beowulf, Age of Heroes, mm-hmm. the book that obviously we are pulling all the show from, and mm-hmm. we managed to get in contact with him. Turns out he lives... relatively close to where I've moved to, which is very nice.
Yep. Let's not give too much about his address away.
No, postcode, blah, blah, blah. And he very kindly agreed to come onto the show and talk a little bit about basically creating this world game and all the other bits and bobs.
What a lovely fella. My voice was a little bit wrecked, so I'm not part of this, unfortunately. But the two of you had a fucking whale of a time, correct?
Correct. Yes, it was wonderful. And said interview shall be coming up now.
He's lying. It's happening now. I win.
Hello, John. Thank you so much for joining us on this wonderful December day. Yeah, thanks for taking the time and coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here and basically us being able to give the listeners a little bit of an insight into the whole, I guess, creative process of bringing Beowulf to life and then getting it out there, and me and Sam then taking it and turning it into maybe what you envisioned, potentially, probably, unlikely the end experience you saw. But hey, we're having a lot of fun playing the game. How are you doing? You good?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, thanks for inviting me on the show. Yeah, no, it's nice to be here. And I certainly don't. I mean, the whole thing when you make games is it's totally cool that you find your own fun with it. You know, I think if we were too prescriptive about how it's supposed to be used, it could get a bit tricky, couldn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Play your fun is wrong. Play my way. Play my fun way.
This way. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Excellent. Well, look. So first things first, just to give everybody the background and where you are and why Handiwork and how that all came into existence, do you want to just like run through? I'm aware that this could go on for quite a long time, but like a whistle stop journey of your background getting into producing RPGs, your background, and why Handiwork Games, what how all this came to fruition.
So sure, yeah, gosh. So I've worked in role-playing games for, oh God, it's probably nearly like 25 years now. I started out as an illustrator, just freelance illustrator, worked on all sorts of indie games, worked on Dungeons & Dragons, worked on lots of different editions of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. There's a classic Brit old-school game called Dragon Warriors, which I did loads of covers for James Wallace's company at the time. Did all sorts, basically. But then took a sort of sideways step into art direction, worked with a company called Cubicle 7, was their art director for many years, transitioned there into being like deputy CEO and creative director there. Probably best known for, and remain best known for, I expect, the One Ring role-playing game, first edition, for which I made loads of artwork and art directed a lot of the books there, and eventually creative directed and wrote on it, which was, jolly nice. And then I always get the year wrong, is it 2018, I think it is? Because we're coming up for our 4-year anniversary at Handiwork. I decided to move on from Cubicle 7 and set up my own firm called Handiwork Games. And the first thing we released pretty much in terms of actual role-playing games was Beowulf Age of Heroes for 5th edition. Since then we've released a few other games. We've got A State, which again is a sort of classic Brit cult classic indie game from the early 2000s. Funnily enough, I live in Falkirk in Scotland now, and A State was created early 2000s in Falkirk by Malcolm Craig and Paul Bourne and a list of others. And we recently licensed that off them, and that's out there now, which is really exciting. That's powered by Forged in the Dark rules rather than 5e, because that just fits better. We're a bit of a broad church when it comes to systems. And then we've just done Masked Witches of Forgotten Dogland, which uses this, in the complete other extreme, this super lightweight, minimalist role-playing game that I wrote called The Silver Road. And Masked Witches of Dogland, Forgotten Dogland rather, sort of came into being like this weird fever dream. It's very, very odd. The whole project's really weird, but just go and look that up on our website if you want to learn more about that. That's not what I'm here to talk about. Beowulf is an absolute labour of love. I mean, we sort of, when we set up the company, we looked at sort of what we could do, what we knew about, what we wanted to do. And that's sort of pretty much how we've worked ever since, really. We just do stuff we think is interesting.
Yeah. Great. I mean, it certainly grabbed mine and Sam's interest, primarily just because of it just works for our format of one DM, one player, because there's been the two of us, and our journey through doing this podcast is me teaching Sam, and now we've got this position where Sam's, a pretty adept player and DM. Like, he's DM'd a few things for me that he's done very well on. Even back in the day, this is off show, but he's done some one-on-one GMing to myself. The fact that you guys sort of created a series of mechanics to explore that and give us this one-on-one D&D experience with the followers and everything like that, what is that something that you set out to create? Was it first off, we're going to do a one-on-one D&D, or was it that we wanted to do Beowulf and the best way to present that is through a one-on-one experience?
Well, those kind of ideas, I think. Now, I could actually just look this up, because this was all created with a group of us on Discord. So there's actually all the logs of everything. But I quite like not remembering, and I just, you know, I'd rather it be a story than me just go look it up. But as I recall, the two ideas were floating around within a sort of similar time frame, in that we wanted to do something with 5th edition because we liked it. I'd written wads of Adventures in Middle-earth, which was the 5e adaptation of The One Ring. And so had Jacob, who was working with me. He had done, sort of overseen all the conversions of the supplements. And so we knew we had good 5e knowledge. There's a guy, David, who had done loads of proofing with and seemed to have a lot of really cool design ideas. He was working with us as well at that point. And 5e was definitely where our heads were at for a project. We wanted to do something kind of low fantasy, early medieval. It's a sort of period of interest to myself and the others working on it, just in its own right, really. And I can't remember exactly which came first, sort of Beowulf as lone hero or one-on-one D&D. I think they came around about the same time, because it really clicked. It was like, oh yeah, there we go. There's the idea that works, you know. Sort of duet play, you know, one GM, one player, and set in the world of Beowulf. I mean, Beowulf's great because it gives you so much room to, because it's a story first and foremost, and it introduces this brilliant, you do not have to be slavish to the history, because it's a story being told by a storyteller, which we like to imagine, you know, sort of in-house. We imagine the storyteller is in, I don't know, we don't set a date on it, but within the sort of early medieval period. So the things they know about are probably the things in the story. But, you know, if they know something different, that can go into your story and still be extremely authentic. You know, you don't have to, you don't have to have a history degree to play it.
No. I mean, that's one of the things is for something that theoretically could be quite challenging, or at least quite a hill to climb. When you say, oh, you're going to just do it, you, one player, one GM, there's nothing really to hide behind. Because when you've got lots of players, you can a lot of the time just put a very small puzzle in front of a group of players, and they can spend a good 2 hours overthinking that puzzle, coming back round to it, trying to fix it, and you as a DM can kind of just sit back and go, oh, it's fine. But it's quite raw, isn't it, that one-on-one experience?
It's quite different, and it's very intense, I think. It kind of needs, you have to be prepared for a bit of a mental shift in that you are just exploring one character's story. And we found some quite surprising differences when we started playing, of just how intense it can get. And you don't have bits where you sit back and it's other people, you know. There's different, when you're playing in a group, there's a different pace of play. Sometimes you've got the spotlight, but other times you are almost spectating and then joining in. Whereas with this, you are playing the whole time, which, you know, it's good for good and ill. I think sometimes it can be a bit, we tend to take more breaks playing Beowulf than we would take in a multiplayer game. Just sometimes you need to just back off a bit and have a break and come back to it.
No, that makes sense. And that's certainly what I've experienced as well. For those of you guys who caught up on the whole, my solo show that we did a couple of weeks back when Sam was unwell, that was basically my outcome of this was, I was very used to not doing as much prep for full sessions for sort of standard D&D. And then we started playing Beowulf and I would be going, oh my God, I've used up all of my notes. I'm now at the sort of end of the story piece and we've only been playing for half an hour. I'm going to have to just throw all this together. But now the back end of that, what that means is it's I've obviously learnt and growing with actually telling these stories. It is different, and it's actually something that challenge, I think, if you're a DM who goes, I know how to DM, it's easy, I've done this for years, I think it's a great switch up and actually allows you to stretch out different muscles as far as storytelling goes.
Definitely.
Well, look, listen, you've also got that narrative that we're talking about and the way that is portrayed. There's additional mechanics that you guys have created to to enforce that narrative and to fix him with that setting. Now, myself and Sam, the way we create ideas and things like that is typically we work with a pun and then go backwards, but right. It's probably slightly different in terms of narratively inputting mechanics into a Beowulf setting. How does that work for you guys from a creative process? How do you get those mechanics in? Do you go story first and then what can we do? Or do you go, this would be a fun mechanic, can we link that to story?
It's a bit of both. I think we usually, everyone working on it kind of had some pet ideas that they've sort of, you know, whenever you're working on things, sometimes ideas come up that you can't use on the current project and you file them away. So you build up a sort of, you know, a back catalogue of stuff that you've got ready to slot in should the opportunity arise. But mostly it was a case of going through the poem and thinking, right, what does this need? And what does this tell us about, you know, for example, followers? You know, this is a big part of what makes Beowulf Age of Heroes work, is that you have this band of followers. But that's very clear very early in the poem, you know, that Beowulf gathers his band of helpers, you know. Mm-hmm. We immediately started embroidering on it because it's not told in any great detail in the poem, but you can instantly see, oh wait, this would, you know, what if you were a hero who had helpers? And you suddenly, you know, things start to present themselves very quickly in the sort of design process. Talking about the sort of shift in pace and so on, we quite quickly realized that you can do more with special rules within combat. That even hearing that coming out of my mouth, that like we added, there's a few extra things that make it more thematic to the period, to do with shields and spears and helmets and things that are very important within the early medieval period. But when you've only got one player, you can have a few more options, and it doesn't matter if one player is spending a bit longer poring over their character sheet because there's only two of you. Whereas of course that's death if you're playing with a group and, you know, half the group is going, oh, wait a minute. And, you know, taking a really long time to make their choices, that's difficult, but it's not so much of a problem, and you can add in a little bit more special stuff.
I suppose that means because you as a GM know what your player has as well, rather than having to remember what five different players have.
Right.
I only need to know the rule set of what this person has, and I can help them with that too.
I really like the idea as well of that between sessions you can work together much more closely, which, say, you know, if you've got four or five players, it's just hard to have the time to work with everyone to any great depth between sessions. But in Beowulf Age of Heroes, if you want, you really can build the world together between sessions and then play it out. I mean, I love that. We do a lot of that.
There's certainly something that we've stumbled upon, and we've actually started to give our listeners the ability to actually influence the story themselves. Awesome. So we're giving them sort of this direction or this direction choice to take Erdwolf through our Discord channel, and they can vote through those pieces, which is because it is one-on-one and you have that space to be able to do it, actually it's not going to break the story, it's not going to explode the world or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's just going to allow, ultimately, the people who are listening to this experience to put themselves into the story as well, and it not take any agency away from myself or Sam telling the story.
Yeah, it's interesting that we sort of discovered again. It's been an interesting sort of discovery process. There's a thing in, say, video games where, you know, smart programming or whatever, you only renders the things the player is looking at. Well, you can do that with one player. You can just, the things they're looking at are all that matter. And you can really develop based around that. And it's a bit of a double-edged sword. You know, like you say, there's less stuff being created compared to playing with a group. But what is created is really focused and really important to the person that's, you know, creating it. So, yeah, it's really interesting, I think.
Nice. Who came up with the old gods and new church dice rule? So the selection between the two before each session, because that one as a rule I absolutely love. It's just,
do you know, that took ages, and it would be wrong of me to credit one person. I'm erring towards Jacob coming up with the final iteration, but we went through so many versions of how we wanted that to work.
It's great. Yeah. It's just such a nice bit of... And reflective of the time of sort of throwing bones and casting fate and all that kind of stuff as an idea before, which ultimately is, you know, rolling a dice is so reflective of that kind of portent and foretelling. Doing it and then choosing it beforehand. Oh, it's love. I love it. I absolutely love that piece. I'm not going to lie. It's one of my favourite parts of the mechanic narrative that gets put together. It's fantastic.
Something I was really insistent that I wanted in it was the stuff Tolkien talks about this sort of melancholic doom, you know, of sort of Northwest European myth that's very... It's, you know, it's ultimately sad, you know, and dooms and so on, and what it's all about, that you're sort of weird may lead you to your own demise, but you sort of embrace it because that's the way that culture works, if you like. And I wanted to be able to, and I wanted there to be mechanically rules where you take the worst option, but it's to your own benefit, ultimately, if you like, you know. And one red herring we chased around for ages was trying to have, because in Beowulf, the alignment is replaced by your religious affiliation or lack thereof. Neither is like good or evil or whatever. This is a ridiculous thing. We were trying to come up with sort of opposite systems that, oh gosh, without going into a lecture on the rise of the early church versus, you know, pre-Christian belief in Norway. But we were trying to sort of sum these things up. And the red herring that had us chasing our tail for a really long time, it was we almost wanted them to be opposed systems, if you like, that the old ways folks would do better when they were sort of failing and embracing their doom, and that the people of the book and the church would be inspired by positivity or something like that. We were chasing around for a while and it was like, no, you've got that wrong. It doesn't need to work that way. But gosh, that tied us up for a long time. And I think it was Jacob that solved it in the end with what you see in the book now. Forgive me, David, if it was David. I think it was Jacob, but yeah, you know, we don't keep score on these things, you know, because that's weird.
Yeah, it's a fantastic mechanic. Really, really do enjoy it. And it helps, you know, one of the big themes in the setting is the new church and the old gods. And I mean, as a theme and as a potential sticking point, that could have been relatively hairy, especially because, you know, we're talking about a church that exists within our world. I mean, obviously, the modern day church is very different to what it was back then in our medieval point. But when you were writing and you know, putting this together, how did you, because you deal with some things that could be potentially quite sticky, potentially quite sticky is probably the right words to use there. How did you approach writing those areas? Because it's done so well, and it's one of the things that when I was first reading the book, when I discovered it and text Sam saying we should do this because it's thought out in a way that places this without a moral compass on it. It's just this exists. So when you were putting that in, what was the process around there?
So really, the root of it is, I was going to say, you know, the glib answer is we did it with enormous care, which is true. You know, we knew this was going to be a difficult topic to cover. Some folks working on it didn't want to touch it at all. They had a real world position that was strongly in favor of not touching it because of where they live. Look at me, I'm like really hedging my language here. They live in a place in the world where one of these two belief systems causes quite a lot of upset in the present day. And they didn't want to touch it. But I don't think you could do Beowulf without, you know, Beowulf is a Christian poem. Whether you like that or not, and then I can hear people listening to this in the future going, "Ah, no, but it's, you know, it's been Christianized." Or, yeah, yes, but still remains, you know, the bit we have written down is a Christian work, and it would just be really rude to not deal with that. Now, in my house, this helps me a great deal. In my household, my wife is very religious, and I am very not religious. And we've raised two boys between us. So, you know, I think I've learned a lot of vocabulary and how does that work? You know, how does our marriage even work? Because we have completely different views of the universe. But, you know, we get on all right. It's just like, you know, good. And I think, you know, that sort of helps. But ultimately, what I was going to say when I first started speaking on this topic was it's the research and the reading. And the more reading I was doing about the early church, and I got really into researching the early church way more than was necessary for this game, because I just found it absolutely fascinating. And you start looking into, like, the Arian heresy and Pelagius and all this sort of stuff. And I thoroughly recommend anyone that just wants something interesting to read about. Read about the early church in the first millennium. It's a very different organization to what we see now. I mean, incredibly different. And the negotiations around things which we assume are just givens, you know, like the Trinity is just this sort of given. Well, that must have, you know, I guess a couple of years after the crucifixion that was decided. No, really not. You know, quite, you know, hot topic of debate and so on, blah, blah, blah. And I think just doing the research and then pulling back from the extreme detail to just be able to present two separate belief systems. In the end, it was much harder to present the old ways, which I think in sort of gaming product circles, people could rattle out a chapter about sort of pre-Christian belief in Europe really quickly, and it would all be extremely dubious and not very well researched because we just don't have the primary sources for this stuff. So it was actually, in the end, it was harder to write about the pre-Christian beliefs, the old ways, than it was the Christian stuff, which was a complete reversal from when it began, because I thought I knew what I was talking about. But then you go and do the reading and you go, oh, I don't know anything at all. And that's, I love that. I mean, that's my stock in trade, really.
Reading. That's part of the parcel, I suppose, of both both areas of belief is and of that time and of the poem is they're all, or a lot of them, it's told history, so it gets somewhat changed in each retelling and somewhat, you know, in each copy there's always room for ambiguity and different things to slip in and different reflections of even their own self. There's even, you know, referencing of gods from the old ways into the new church and all that kind of thing, and it all comes.
There's a lot there, and it's really good if you can, you know, once you start writing scenarios, and if you're overseeing, as we've done, several people writing scenarios, and even in a simple sort of slice that pie into four segments, which is like good person, bad person, old ways, new church. And, you know, combine those in different ways, and you make sure you're combining them in different ways. Like, just the real world, you know, it's not actually that difficult. We can't have... Oh, another great thing we used a lot of were these touchstones like Friar Tuck Christianity. Obviously, Friar Tuck is a much later character than the Age of Beowulf. But that kind of... You know how Friar Tuck appears in English folk? He is religious, but he's not sort of the evil bishop or the sort of, you know, he has no power. He is genuinely religious, and it's like this is what we need to touch on, you know, it's that stuff. There was a lot in there, and it's good. You couldn't do it, but the poem Beowulf is about digesting a conversion, you know, to Christianity amongst its authors. I mean, you know, there's a lot of different theories as well about how this was, you know, that perhaps it was even commissioned by Danes settling in, you know, the British Isles, and they were even, you know, they weren't Christian at all. But I mean, yeah, blah blah blah. I could go on a lot about where the poem comes from.
Hey, look, it's great. I might scratch your brains after that. We actually get off the call on that one for sure. Well, look, I think this leads me on quite nicely to the next question, because you've mentioned that obviously we've got different scenarios out there that we've had. Or I say we, you've had different writers come in and work on, and as well as other ones written by yourself, to create, you know, various modules. And obviously you've just had a very successful Kickstarter, which I think is now closed. So I can't even help do a plug on that one, I'm afraid.
A little while ago, closed that one. Yeah. However,
that means that you've got all these modules out there and different stories that are floating through. So what's the most challenging aspect about writing those modules and getting those stories to print?
That's a tough question. There's like, I mean, I was quite surprised. I was just thinking back over the ones we've published, keeping the, in terms of sort of overseeing them being written, it's keeping them varied, but sort of on topic, if you like, or suit to having suitable adversaries with enough variety and that kind of stuff, and not allowing enough room for the player, I think, within them is, it can be tricky. But something I immediately thought about was that the one in, so we've just released The Trials of the Twin Seas, which collects six adventures together. And the scenario mm-hmm. I wrote in there, because I'd written The Hermit's Sanctuary, which is free, and people should just rush out and get that if they're interested in any of this, because it's free, it's a full adventure, it's got all the rules you need to play. Any nominated, no less. I'd written that, and that one is so sort of emblematic of what you would do in a Beowulf adventure. Then writing another one was like, oh, this is going to be, you know, I've got to dig really deep to find new things to do. You know, did I say everything in that first one? And it's like, no, of course I didn't. But the next one I wrote, The Witches and the Worm, is almost completely gonzo. It's like, it's totally different. And it kind of, I think it stands out a bit in that collection as being sort of, you know, you wash up on a beach in this sort of other world place, you know, and there's no realism to the location whatsoever. Quite deliberately, it makes very little sense, but in realism terms. But yeah, it's more it's keeping it all shepherded to be a coherent whole, I think, and that it makes sense that mm-hmm. one player could play across those adventures. But yeah, it's what is the hardest part? I don't know. It's hard to say in just one aspect. Making sure you're balancing what, because there's only one player, balancing what they're doing across the adventure, and I feel quite strongly they need a little bit of everything to make them good, because you've only got one player and you've got no chat. You've got no chat coming from the rest of the party. The chat is only coming from your followers and NPCs.
Are we talking your external characters, the things that your GM would be providing in terms of?
Yeah.
I guess points to bounce off.
I quite like the idea that the player could end up almost playing with them, doing their character and their followers, and almost having, I've seen it in the game I run where the player realizes they're sort of arguing with themselves through like three different characters, and that's quite joyful actually and quite nice. So trying to make that happen in a useful way by putting the player, when they're not talking to non-player characters that are GM run, when it's just them and their followers, they're in an interesting situation where the followers might have something to say. And constantly, you know, we constantly write into the adventures, you know, followers may think this, they might think that. Mm-hmm. And I think that the follower space is a really interesting one, because they are a kind of shared character between the GM and the player. And they're a very good conduit for a good GM to feed information to the player. You've got to be careful how you do that. So it's not just, you know, the follower shouldn't be telling you what to do.
Here's my exposition dump via one follower.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. If you know all this, why are you just standing around and not doing anything about it?
Get your own ship, mate. But that's it. But they can sort of, I think when you get a good relationship with your player, you can have the followers sort of squinting and frowning and going, don't fancy this. You know, it's a good way to say this. You know, if you've had any sort of role-playing game where the player maybe wants to climb down that cliff they're not really supposed to be climbing down, and you're going, look, this is a really bad idea. Like, are you sure? Are you sure? And they're like, yes. And
yeah.
And they die.
Yeah.
Whereas you've got some breaks with the followers, I think, quite, you know, helpful.
Just go, let's just think about what we're going to do before we do it, shall we?
Yeah. Someone was telling us in a playtest of The Hermit Sanctuary, we rewrote it in part to deal with this, that like they all died scaling down. There's a bit where you scale down some cliffs and they all kind of threw themselves down the cliff and all died, which wouldn't really happen in a game I was running. You know, you'd be like, oh no, you'd get a scene out of it, but it wouldn't be everyone dying. It'd be everyone really badly hurt, but they just wiped out at the bottom of the cliff. You're like, wow. Oh no, I think we need to maybe break up the cliff a little bit. So just people can't. a
couple of tears, so at least if they fall, they've got a great.
Yeah.
Excellent. Look, last question, but I think it's got to be an important one because, that's the nature of any sort of show and performance is the finale should be a big one, he says, but I'm actually going to ask an inane, silly question anyway. Look, so Beowulf and Handiwork, you have created some absolutely gorgeous peripherals to this game.
Mm.
So just some of those tokens, some of those dice, there some of the minis and all that kind of stuff. They're absolutely gorgeous. Like, this isn't sort of just blowing smoke. I genuinely think they're
just blow
some
away,
of the best sort of internally created products to go with a book that I've seen out there on the market.
Well, thank you very much.
That's quite all right. What's your favourite, John? You know, which one do you look at and you go, oh, I'm pleased that we did that, or secretly it was you going, I want this, and I'm just going to use the budget to get something that I want out of it?
I'm torn two ways, so I'm going to cheat and do two. The coins, definitely. The inspiration tokens, because they feed into sort of some of my really favourite rulesy bits. And also, we just went berserk on those in that they're as big as can be made. You know, they're really big. They're really thick. They've got like gems on them and so on.
Mm.
And I think they're just great. They are exactly what I wanted them to be. And there was no compromise in making those, you know. The other one is the miniatures were just really enjoyable to do. There was some beautiful serendipity there where I found a very old friend of mine, the sculptor, Richard Dickens. He lives just across the water from us in Fife. I had no idea he was practically local. And we sort of got back in touch after, I don't know, 20 years of lapsing out of touch. And, you know, he could sculpt us miniatures, which he did.
great.
And it was really great. And, he did an absolutely fantastic job. And they're absolutely spot on. And it was just a lovely thing to do. I know various people who have dabbled in miniatures and got very badly burned doing so. And I felt it was really nice. We kept it, you know, it's a box of miniatures. We're not a miniatures producer, if you like. We were able to make just a box of miniatures that were the sort of miniatures we wanted to make. They're really satisfied with those. A bit nerve-wracking that I ended up painting them myself and photographing them myself for the box, which was not the original plan. But I think it worked out all right.
It's good. What I will say is the miniatures, I presume they came after the book. They reflect the artwork so well, compared like between the what you see in the pages and what you get out as a mini, it's very impressive actually, because you have a look at your Reaper minis and you go that's a drow or something like that, and you go well that looks completely different to what it would be in the book, but whatever, that's fine. I'll paint that up and put it out. Yeah, exactly. But these they really really reflect the artwork that's put there. Great, impressive. I've already sort of somewhat raved about how good I think the peripherals are, but yeah, great. Well, look, John, I think that's enough yabbering that we've done, and hopefully that gives our listeners a decent insight into what it goes into sort of building and creating things like this. Just before we finish, is there anything that you would like to plug, anything you want to push, and spend some time and just put it out there and see what other people can, if they've enjoyed Beowulf or they're enjoying Beowulf, what's the next step that they could go on to and discover within Handiwork for you?
So we have very recently opened a pre-order for Trials of the Twin Seas, which is this book of adventures for Beowulf. So definitely check that out, because it's another beautiful book. You know, it's a spot varnish on the cover again and all singing, all dancing. Definitely just head to our website, handiwork.games, and have a good look around. There's a lot of stuff there. You know, there's a lot of good stuff. And it's all made to that kind of standard. We spend far too long obsessing about. We were talking this morning very quickly. We were talking about there's a current sort of, it doesn't matter what it is. There's a controversy at the moment in around a particular game that's sort of historically based. And I was like, the amount that we sweat bullets over the sort of politics of all of it. We're really careful about all that. But it's all made like that. You know, it's all, everything we do is, you know, the politics of Forgotten Doggerland, this sort of Mesolithic setting. I really worried about all that. And we you know, we try quite hard to make these things, I don't know, sort of fair somehow. I don't know. But we care about stuff, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Definitely.
There's a lot there. There's a lot to look at. And, you know, who doesn't like nice toys? This is it with all the accessories. You know, I'm not mucking about making rubbish stuff that I don't want. It's all stuff I want.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, look, we'll put links in the show notes. Brilliant. So, and I'm sure that listeners probably have already gone over to the website and had a gander, but it's worth making it nice and easy for them. So, check out the show notes, guys, if you're having a look, if anything's caught your ear or well, obviously ear in this format, but eye when you go to the website. Enjoy. John, thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Really appreciate it. You never know. We might get you back on later on. See if we can.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, maybe have a NPC turn up at some point for Sam to have a conversation with.
Yeah, that'd be fun. It?
Yeah, it would be good. Excellent. Thank you, John. Speak soon. No,
thank you. Bye now.
Ah, Sam, wasn't John a good guest?
What a guess. I mean, that the rabbit hole about like the pre-medieval church and gods, that was fairly intimidating. I thought I knew a lot about some stuff, but like, yeah, fair play to going down that and making sure we had it nailed on.
Yeah, I mean that's I suppose part of that question is around like obviously you're potentially touching on something which could be a touchy subject or a sticky situation and the way you prepare yourself for that is by doing the research, which undoubtedly,
yeah, no shit.
You know, they've right, got done, which is, yeah, exactly. Yeah, fantastic. Really good. Yeah, and then obviously a nice, what's your favorite thing that you've made on the side? Yeah.
Made a pie. Lovely pie.
Brilliant. Look, well, that was really nice. And obviously, as we said, we might have John on again.
I would love to chat to him this time. That would be great.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Well, he may appear as an NPC, and we're going to figure out how that works.
Stop
in the future. I know.
Don't tease me, Sylvester. Do not tease me. Okay.
That's, give you such that's, lovely okay, things, don't that, I?
This has become something it never should have been. But in a way, was always supposed to. Anyway.
Brilliant. Well, look, thank you everybody for stopping by and listening. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Mm-hmm. As always, we've been Starter Set. You have been our listeners. Roll well, and we will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bidely bye.
Did you like the return to the old way of finishing the show?
I did. We hope you liked it too, listeners.